This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The report is exciting. It shows that choice is something that's changing the world. In the 1800s, for example, the world had one rate of childbearing, and it was high. Nowadays, there's a variety of childbearing rates, and it differs between developing countries and countries that are already developed.
That's Dr. Natalia Kanim, Executive Director of the United Nations Sexual and Reproductive Health Agency. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, the mass expulsion of an estimated 200,000 Congolese from Angola into Congo's Kasai Central province could trigger a humanitarian crisis. Zimbabweans on the streets and economists say nothing has changed and want the government to address the melting economy. And the Liberian government will reopen the investigation into sexual abuse of impoverished young girls at the More Than Me Academy in Monrovia.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization meets tomorrow to decide if the Ebola outbreak in the DRC constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. The question reflects the situation in eastern DRC, where health officials wonder if the situation is getting better or worse. There's been an increase in new cases recently, but that could be caused by better reporting after initial resistance by local residents to the international aid effort. Every day, aid agencies such as Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, assess the constantly changing security situation in an active conflict zone and try to help where they can. The death toll has hit 100 from 211 confirmed and suspected cases. John Johnson, MSF's project coordinator for Beni, which has become the outbreak's epicenter, spoke with my colleague Paul Alexander about the challenges.
The epidemic is sort of not yet at a stopping point. We still see some active chains of transmission, so it's being very closely followed by the teams that are doing active case finding, by the teams that are doing follow-up of contacts of confirmed cases, and all the other surveillance teams trying to get a handle on where the cases are coming from, where they're spreading, and trying to be one step ahead of the cases as they show up in new places. I'm located in Beni, and Beni has become the new epicenter of the epidemic. Originally, in early August and September, it was a town about 45 minutes from here called Mangina. The efforts put in place there made it so that today there are no confirmed cases in Mangina, but we're seeing the last couple weeks in Beni there have been 14, I think, the week that just passed, and 11 the week before that. So we're still working on getting things under control in Beni.
Is there a sense that things are getting better or worse?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's really hard to say from week to week. What I can say is we're finding a lot more alerts than we had before. And that's not necessarily because there's more cases, but it's because the alert system has been improved. So when you see more and more alerts coming in, that doesn't necessarily mean more cases. It just means that we're being more efficient in finding them.
Is security still the main concern, and are your staff concerned about their own safety?
Security definitely poses a lot of challenges in this area because there are certain areas that we have difficulty to access. We've known that. That's nothing new. There's been years of conflict and violence in North Kivu and especially right around this area. So we have to be creative in how we reach out to people. There's certain red zones where we just don't go. And we have to check from day to day what the situation on the ground is before we send out our teams. All that being said, we're able to still do the work, you know, with minor constraints from time to time where we have to stop movements or wait until things calm down. I think this, you know, for the people that live here and our staff are locals, I think this has been their life for so long they've adapted. And they know when to be careful and when to when to not go out and when to when things are more calm, when they can, you know, move about freely.
Now, officials have said that they are going to try to crack down on the unsafe burials and bring in troops for security. Have you seen any improvements in that area?
The sort of idea that they're going to enforce this by way of the police, that hasn't been implemented yet. I'd say from our point of view, it's not necessarily the most effective way to get people to cooperate. I think measures that are incentive work better than measures that are coercive. But, you know, any type of resistance for safe burial practices, for going to the Ebola treatment center, is completely normal and very human. In any Ebola outbreak, you see this. In other Ebola outbreaks, it's often the same story. People don't want to go to the treatment center because it's a very terrifying place to go. You know that in the best case scenario, about 50% of Ebola patients die. The measures that we work on with the rest of the Ebola outbreak response is community awareness campaigns and dialogues to sort of help us understand what are the measures that will get the community to begin to cooperate with this Ebola response rather than sort of resist.
That was John Johnson of Doctors Without Borders speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander.
The United Nations Refugee Agency warns the mass expulsion of an estimated 200,000 Congolese from Angola into Congo's unstable Kasai Central province could trigger a humanitarian crisis. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Ethnic tensions that triggered a brutal conflict in the Kasai region of the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2016 are still running high. The UN Refugee Agency says the arrival of another 200,000 people into the area could further destabilize this fragile region. Over the past 2 weeks, Angola has expelled the Congolese migrants who were working as informal miners in the northeastern part of the country. Angolan authorities say they want to shut down this illegal activity. But UNHCR spokesman Barbara Balash says the sudden arrival of such a huge number of people has created a chaotic situation in Kasai, which is unprepared to handle them.
People have been arriving in DRC through different border points with whatever belongings they can bring. We have heard complaints of violence, including sexual violence and harassment, bodily frisking, and theft of belongings at the hands of the security forces on both sides of the border.
Balosh says the UNHCR is also concerned about reports that a small number of refugees may have been caught up in the mass movement and been forced to return to the DRC. Angola currently hosts some 68,000 refugees and asylum seekers. The UNHCR notes that mass expulsions are contrary to obligations under the African Charter. The agency is appealing to the governments of Angola and the DRC to work together to ensure safe and orderly returns. In the meantime, it says those who have been forcibly returned are in dire straits. Most have few, if any, belongings, and all are in need of food, water, shelter, and other basic services. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Sexual and Reproductive Health Agency, UNFPA, will release a groundbreaking report tomorrow on how reproductive choices can bolster economic and social development. The report, entitled State of the World Population 2018, explores reproductive rights around the world and the link with countries' fertility levels. It found that the differences in fertility rates across the globe are wider now than at any other time in history. The report also reveals that sub-Saharan Africa is expected to contribute more than half of the anticipated growth in world population from now until 2050, with about 1.3 billion people. Dr. Natalia Canham is executive director of UNFPA. She spoke with me about the report's findings.
The report is exciting. It shows that choice is something that's changing the world. In the 1800s, for example, the world had one rate of childbearing, and it was high. Nowadays, there's a variety of childbearing rates, and it differs between developing countries and countries that are already developed.
In developing countries, what do you find?
In developing countries, we see high rates of childbearing, and we see that choice is an issue for women who would prefer to have smaller families. They simply lack the access to modern contraception that would be empowering for them in terms of limiting family size. The rate of childbearing ranges from as many as an average of 7+ children per woman, and they simply do not want to have that many children. There's a big demand for contraception.
Also in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa continues to contribute more than half of the anticipated growth in world population, and it does have the highest fertility of all. So what really does that mean for Africa as a whole, looking at economics, and then for women, what does that mean?
Very interesting question. For women in particular, for their choice, the inability to access contraception means that having more children than you would like pretty much takes you off the chessboard when it comes to being able to participate in the labor market, and most significant, when it comes to be able to finish your education. This obviously has implications for economies as a whole, and this is why the African Union and many African governments have seen the need to invest in young people. There is a connection between education. A well-educated girl typically chooses to have fewer children if she has access to the contraception that she needs.
How can they get access to contraception in their local communities where they live, and how can they also empower themselves regarding this?
The report that UNFPA publishes this week shows very clearly that leaving no one behind means making contraception available in her village health post, in her island community, wherever she may be. Couples are not able to fulfill their potential, nor that of their children, when they don't have access. So for UNFPA, it means working hand in hand with governments to be sure that contraception in a variety of methods, everything from condoms to pills to injectables to implants, are readily available in a voluntary way for women that would like it.
On the gender discrimination and how this is affecting the population overall and the power of choice for women.
Discrimination by gender is one of the big factors in limiting choice. It starts even in the womb, where boy preference can be a detriment to women. Later, there are many strictures against adolescent girls, for example, accessing information and accessing services that they would need to stay healthy and to avoid unintended pregnancy. The gender inequality that limits women's choices in all areas of their life, not just decisions about children, limits their option for education, for their careers, and even for their longevity because there are health consequences.
That was Dr. Natalia Canham, Executive Director of UNFPA. She spoke with me from London.
Zimbabwe's government says the country is emerging from a recent economic meltdown that witnessed shops run out of goods and motorists spend long hours in lines at gas stations. But as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, economists say Zimbabwe's crisis is not over, as people have no confidence in the currency or in President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government.
For weeks now, there have been long and winding queues at most fuel stations in Zimbabwe as the precious liquid has been in short supply. Lamek Mauriri is one of those now tired of the situation.
We are really striving, but things are tough. Things are tough, especially to everyone. I don't know those who are in rural areas, how are they surviving? Especially if in Harare it's like this.
How is it like in Harare?
We are sleeping in queues. There's no fuel, there's no bread, there's no drinks. There's nothing. There's no cash, no jobs.
For a decade, the country has been without an official currency and relied on US dollars, the British pound, and South African rand to conduct transactions. In the past 3 years, however, all three currencies have been hard to find, paralyzing the economy. The introduction of bond notes, a currency Zimbabweans started printing 2 years ago to ease the situation, has not helped. The bond notes were supposed to trade at par with the US dollar, but on the black market, a dollar is now equal to close to three bond notes. Prosper Chitambara, an economist of the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe, says the bond notes are partly to blame for the price increases and shortages in the country.
What is lacking in the market, in the system, in the economy is confidence. There's a distrust among economic agents of the formal economic system. The bond notes, they've contributed definitely to the current situation, the palace economic situation. Definitely they've contributed a great deal. What they've done is to increase, for example, money supply in the economy. And that money supply is not actually backed by significant improvements in productivity. That actually gives rise to inflationary pressure, the generation of inflationary pressures.
He said the government's recent introduction of a 2% tax on all electronic transactions pushed prices even higher and caused some shops to close. Damaningi Nick Mangwana, Zimbabwe's secretary in the Ministry of Information and Publicity, says the situation in the country is normal and there's no need for alarm.
There is no shortage of the oil itself. There is no challenge in terms of the production of all these essential services. That's why they are there in the shops right now, if you go. There were a few people that panicked, closed a couple of shops, but those ones opened within hours. So really, yeah, there was fake news and people panicked, but it's all under control now.
That is not exactly what seems to be the case on the ground. Some shops remain closed and prices continue rising. Long fuel lines remain the order of the day. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The Liberian government will reopen the investigation into sexual abuse of impoverished young girls at the More Than Me Academy in Monrovia. The decision follows the ProPublica and Time magazine investigative report into years of abuse at the charity founded by an American woman, Katie Meller. The man accused of the abuse was tried on charges of raping 10 girls, but it ended in a mistrial. He died in 2016 before he could be retried. The journalist who wrote the report, Finley Young, told our colleague James Buddy he's encouraged by the new investigation.
Certainly to see the Liberian government really taking this seriously and really looking into exactly what happened, as we tried to do with our reporting, I think is a really good sign.
Young says he is glad the report is people talking about issues with international aid. More Than Me began funding scholarships for girls at risk of sexual abuse in 2010 and opened its first school in 2013. Liberia now plans to tighten oversight for schools and programs for children.
There wasn't really that much regulation of them, and the bureaucratic systems, perhaps at the time, were also not that strong in Liberia. So certainly, I think in various ways, harm could have been mitigated or even prevented had there been greater oversight, primarily within the organization, but also over the organization from structures within Liberia.
The More Than Me Liberian Advisory Board has created an independent panel to investigate the allegations in Young's report. The chairman today told VOA the board won't make public comments until the panel completes its work in a few weeks. More Than Me received most of its funds from American charities and wealthy donors. However, in 2014, its financial statement shows it received nearly $600,000 from the U.S. State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development. USAID says it is looking into its grants to the charity.
France and Italy's different priorities have complicated international efforts to stabilize Libya. The U.S. government supports Italy's initiative to host an international conference on Libya next month. France aims to keep Libya from becoming a hub for spreading terrorism into the former French colonies in North Africa and the Sahel. Paris backs the commander of the Libyan National Army, who succeeded in rooting out Islamist militants in the east. On the other hand, Italy supports the government of National Accord in Tripoli to preserve its energy supply and curb African immigrants from crossing into Italy from western Libya. Muftah Yayar is the former Libyan ambassador to Mexico. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about how the Franco-Italian tension could hamper any potential solutions for Libya.
Unfortunately, right now, the French-Italian competition is going the wrong way. Italy want to intervene in Libya, basically to stop the illegal immigrant movement in Libya. Also, Italy want to protect its economic interest. On the other hand, French President Macron is actively engaged to restore France's role in the world. Libya is close from an old French colonies, and Libya can play an important role in getting in touch with these states. So the goals of the two countries are not the same, which lead me to conclude that the competition right now, its impact is negative, and it's complicating, in fact, things on Libya. I hope, and the Libyan hope, that France and Italy can build up a better relation and better view about Libya.
How do you explain France's backing of General Haftar and Italy's latest attempt to negotiate with him?
France, from the beginning, backed Haftar, and they supported him logistically and politically. Haftar did some achievement on the ground. He got into a fight with what he called the extremists. So I understand exactly why do the French would like to get closer to Haftar as long as he is the one who is controlling it. On the other hand, Italy do not want to stay away from this fact that Haftar is important and he must play a role in any negotiation. If Italy want to bring all the parties to the next conference in November, then it is important that Haftar will be on the table with them.
President Trump said the United States would not play any active role in Libya beyond fighting ISIS. What would push the United States to play a different role in Libya?
I think President Trump and those who are making foreign policy decisions in Washington, D.C., need to look at the following. The first one is any development in the uranium file. When there is a tension between Iran and United States, that might lead to an increase in the prices of oil. So any development in this direction could push Trump and others to get involved in Libya, because Libya can replace any shortage in the market. The other thing is, if the United States thought that the tension between Italy and France in particular have exceeded its limits and is threatening the safety and peace in the whole region. Also, finally, if Trump would like to play an active role in Libya and his administration, is that America, just like the others, want its share from gas and oil in Libya and also from commerce and economics in Libya. I might conclude by saying that last two appointments in the United Mission, Special United Mission in Libya, two Americans. One was Stephanie Williams, which was the appointed as a assistant to Hassan Salama, and the latest one last month was Jeffrey Feltman as a consultant. This means that there is an increase understanding and also a hint that President Trump and his administration are paying attention to Libya.
That was former Libyan ambassador to Mexico, Muftah Yayar. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
With Yehaya Swuhib, I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the VOA.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.